And our sermon text this day is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 12 to 17. And somebody please call out that number for me when you get there. We should be familiar enough with this. We don't need it, but just in case somebody needs that, what page is that on, please? 554. Ecclesiastes 2, 12 to 17. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there was more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there was more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this is also vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. We are familiar with many of our founding fathers. Their names are ubiquitous: George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams. Yet there is one whose name is conspicuous because of its absence. You know who this is? He's known as the forgotten founder. This luminous founding father, who has been largely forgotten, is George Mason, a delegate to the Constitutional Convention from Virginia. The best biography of him is by Jeff Broadwater, and it's entitled George Mason, Forgotten Founder. Do you know why he's considered so crucial to crafting the Constitution, making it what it is today? Well, Mason was the author of the Virginia Bill of Rights that became the basis for our own Bill of Rights. And like the anti-federalist Patrick Henry — did you know that both Mason and Henry argued against the Constitution as it is presently constituted? Well, Mason argued strenuously against ratifying the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. He ended up voting against the Constitution. He was a strong proponent of a weaker federal government and a stronger role for states' rights. And although the Constitution was ratified eventually without a Bill of Rights, what we now know as the Ten Amendments, the Bill of Rights, was added later to the Constitution as amendments, primarily because of Mason's persuasive argumentation. And although he was a slave owner, Mason fought for the banning of further importation of slaves and slavery's extension into other territories as well, banning it as well. He also insisted that there should be no state church and that the government should not financially support any single church. The language of the First Amendment is his. This forgotten founder has slowly been getting his due in the recent past. In 2002, a memorial was built and dedicated to him, a stone's throw from Jefferson Memorial. Of course, George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, is named in his honor. Finally, a bas-relief sculpture of him is now in the House chamber, along with 22 other great lawmakers, just above and to the right of the speaker's chair. Broadwater's book. It's a good read. Perhaps the most thorough work on this founding father to date, George Mason, Forgotten Founder. How does someone so crucial to our history go unnoticed for so long, huh? Sink into obscurity. How does someone so crucial to our history fade from our collective memory. How many other great men lie in relative obscurity in their graves, while what they have done, said, and accomplished goes unnoticed, unsung by subsequent generations? We don't know, of course, because by definition, if they're forgotten, we don't remember them or know them, do we? What we do not remember, we cannot know. So it is with wisdom, as Solomon, as Koheleth will unfold for us in our text today. In reality, we must say that this phenomenon is easily susceptible and frequent, especially the older you get. Solomon makes it an explicit point in his work before us today, as he seeks to breed wisdom within the heart and mind of his succeeding sons. Will they rule wisely? Will their labors endure past one fleeting generation? Will their memory be famous, infamous, or just plain lost to antiquity? To this conundrum, Koheleth now addresses himself. Let us take up our text then today. I have 3 points that I want to make with you. On the inside flap of your bulletin, you will find a brief outline from verses 12 and 13 today. Forgotten. Forgotten. Vaporous nature of life and all that is permanent and remains. Nothing is permanent. Remains, it does it. It's vaporous. And part of the sketch of that is because we forget so often. Because it is in the nature of the curse and in our nature to forget. Forgotten, therefore, is our title. Forgotten. The wise king knows that wisdom is better than folly, even though it's forgotten by the next king. The wise king knows that wisdom is better than folly, even though it's forgotten by the next king. Now, as we have observed for you in the past, as we've been unfolding the book of Ecclesiastes, it is a universal composition. That is, it deals with the wide range of human experience that all of us encounter. That's why it's perhaps one of the most evangelistic books in the Old Testament, too. That along with, who's the guy that got swallowed? By the whale, Jonah. Yeah, that's another very evangelist. The guy, that guy. Yeah. See, my memory is fading fast as well. Remember his mission. Remember Solomon's mission. He said, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. Chapter 1 is largely an introduction to his themes and his method, too. And I just want to review those very briefly for you. His themes: all is vapor. All is vaporous. That's the literal translation of the Hebrew word hebel, isn't it? English translations render it commonly as vanity, the text in your lap, if it's King James or ESV, translates it as vanity. Or perhaps you have an NIV in your lap, in which case it's that word hebel is translated as meaninglessness. And although we can still arrive at proper conclusions using these translations, they're impediments. And the literal rendering is far preferable, that is, vapor, because it vividly communicates that which Koheleth wishes to say. That is, all we count as enduring is brief and transitory. The second theme that he lays out for us, the second motif constantly running through Ecclesiastes, is that for the sake of argument, I restrict myself to that which is observable under the sun. We see that phrase constantly, don't we? All laced all the way through Ecclesiastes. That which is done under the sun. So much of what Solomon experiences, frustration, exasperation, even hatred, as we'll see today, can be attributed to the ultimate brevity of everything that happens in this life. Owing to the nature of the curse, primarily. You see, he's alluded to the curse on numerous occasions and will in the future too. His deliberate use of this phrase, under the sun, eventually begs the response, what then, pray tell, lies above the sun? That's one of our evangelistic levers that we have with lost men and women as well. The third motif, laced all through Ecclesiastes, there is much sweet nectar in the flower of life. Don't discount this. He unfolds for us many times, there is much sweet nectar in the flower of life. As Koheleth takes up each component of life, he will pronounce it good when guided by wisdom. Work, pleasure, love, life are all good and sweet, albeit fleeting. That's his complaint. Just all so brief, Lord. And then fourthly, there is nothing new under the sun. There is nothing new under the sun. Given the evidence presented us under the sun, all we can conclude is that life is cyclical. It's consistent with all other world cosmologies, isn't it? What has been will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. But Koheleth, in addition to these motifs, he also has a particular method by which he approaches this experiment, doesn't he? He also has a method. Two primary components in his method. Number one, figuratively, he's saying, I am an empiricist in that I test all by experience. I test all by experience. Solomon does not leave anything to hearsay or knowledge by word of mouth. He experiences all about what he pronounces judgment by direct experience. Work, pleasure, sex, power, wealth, these are all plumbed to their depths by Solomon personally. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, he says. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. Whatever he concludes, Solomon concludes because he knows it to his toenails, doesn't he? Second component of his method. I am a biblicist, he says, in paraphrase, right? I am a biblicist in that I test all by wisdom. I test all by experience and wisdom. Despite what other commentators speculate, Solomon's wisdom never leaves him. Even when he ironically plumbs folly, my wisdom remained with me, he says, my heart still guiding me with wisdom. And as we observed last week, there's no reason to take these statements and others like them as ironic either. They must be taken on their face. Let me also remind you of the genre of this work. That is, it is wisdom literature with a target audience. It's not meant to be easy. You don't have answers lying around on the surface that you could just calmly and casually pick up and say, oh, here's a nice proof text. No. This is wisdom literature meant to be wrestled with, and it has a target audience, and that is Solomon's sons. Solomon's sons who must follow after him. Solomon deliberately constructed Ecclesiastes as a conundrum. You've heard me use that term several times already. The book of Ecclesiastes is a large conundrum. And we know from the Oxford English Dictionary, a conundrum is a riddle, especially with a pun in the answer, a puzzling question. Therefore, it's not glib and easy. You can't skim Ecclesiastes with easy fruit. It would require thought and wise reflection by each of his succeeding sons to unravel and apply to the living present circumstances that his sons would face subsequent to his demise. Therefore, the wisdom does not lie on the surface, easily skimmed as if cream. No, it is not susceptible to proof texting. Much of this is evident in our text today. Koheleth says, so I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Who is the man here in our text then? Who is the man? Implicitly, he is the one who comes after Solomon, the inheritor of the throne of David. The one who comes after the king, i.e. him. This is one of those keys that indicates Ecclesiastes was composed for his sons, kings who would come after him. What then precisely is it that sons following him can do? What is it they can do? Only what has already been done, he says. Cyclical in nature, isn't it? Only what has already been done. But there's positive in that. What has been, will be, and what is What will be is even now. Therefore, if that's the case, if Koheleth can test wisdom fully, as he does, will not the path of his successors be made that much easier? Solomon having walked all the paths of life before his sons. If indeed they will only reprise what Solomon has done already, they will be able to rule this people, as he calls them in 1 Kings, wisely. This is precisely why he can conclude unreservedly, "Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness." So he affirms the good nature, character, quality of wisdom. If he gets it right, and his sons follow in his footsteps, certain blessings will flow, will they not? That's the constant theme of the wisdom literature. Proverbs, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction." Or in Psalms, "The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you.' My son, beware of anything beyond these proverbs," as he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. So, for all men, and in particular for his sons to follow in his reign, wisdom pays more dividends than folly. One's life is more fruitful, filled with less evil, blessed by God far more than if he had followed the way of the fool. This is not ironic in the text. It is not disingenuous. This is not disingenuous, self-deceived blather meant to really indicate that Solomon is off the tracks. He's really behaving like a fool. No. This tack, if you take that tack continuously, and many do, it only makes senseless, worthless hash of the text. And you only have a verse or two here where he speaks of God that surfaces as of any worth in Ecclesiastes. Rather, Koheleth's conclusion is in full consonance with the rest of wisdom literature. Proverbs 4, chapter 18, verses 18 and 19, for example, says much of what he says here. He says, "But the path of righteousness is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until the full day. The way of the wicked is like deep darkness. They do not know over what they stumble," from Proverbs chapter 4. Proverbs 22 and verse 3, "The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it." Jesus used light and darkness as a contrast all through his ministry as well, doesn't he? John chapter 12, verse 35, "The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going." You see these themes reprised time and time again in Scripture. Solomon is not saying something here that he will take back later. This is full-orbed truth about wisdom. He's not schizophrenic, demonstrating one personality and mode of thinking here that is optimistic and affirmative, and then later throwing up his hands and exclaiming in despair, "All is vain and empty and fruitless," is he? Not doing that. He is commending for his sons, and by extension, us and our sons, that wisdom truly is better than folly. It garners more gain and is as different as light is from darkness. So this is an overarching biblical truth. It is not hedged, chiseled, or denigrated in all of Ecclesiastes. It will be tempered and qualified in the human heart, but not dispensed with as a rule of life. What he will observe is a truth that every lost man knows to his toenails, however. Wisdom is fleeting. It is ephemeral. It is as fleeting as vapor when remembered by the next generation. Forgetfulness is the rule, remembrance the exception. Wisdom thus retains all of its intrinsic value. It is the vaporous communication of it to the subsequent generation that makes it so hateful in his mind, makes it so grievous. And this truth is fleshed out for us in the following verses. So let's turn to point 2, verses 14 and 15. Forgotten. The wise king. He is a wise king. He hopes to inculcate that wisdom to his sons. So the wise king knows that he can make his way, even though his end is as imminent as the fool. Following up on his previous reflections, Koheleth crafts an apt proverb. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Solomon underlines, as he does so often, doesn't he, an exposition he'll give us for a few moments, and then he'll isolate and he'll sum it up very eloquently in a proverb. And here he is underlining that theme of wisdom noted previously. The man who diligently seeks wisdom proceeds along life's path as if illumined by a light, while the fool stumbles around as if in thick darkness. But our persistent theme of the fleeting, ephemeral nature of all things and its consequent impact on the human heart are magnified for us here. The impact of that on the human heart is what it causes him to exclaim as he does. And he begins that exclamation with, "And yet." Okay, wisdom is valuable. Better than folly, as light is over darkness. "And yet," he says. In contrast, bubbling up within his breast is vexation, sorrow, yea, hatred. Here the great utility and efficacy of wisdom is tempered, as I mentioned before, is tempered. "I perceived," that is with the employment of wisdom, "I perceived that the same event happens to all of them." The Hebrew word for event here is not limited to one single isolated happening, but can also involve a series of events or a process. And the question arises, what is the event to which Koheleth refers? Huh? The same event happens to all? Now, most commentators see that event as death. Indeed, he alludes to it, and ultimately, yes. But don't ignore the major motif to which Koheleth refers. That is, both the wise and the fool are forgotten. Both the wise and the fool are forgotten. This is in the forefront of his thinking and his exasperation. "For of the wise as of the fool, there's no enduring remembrance, seeing that in days to come all will have been long forgotten." All will have been long forgotten. Koheleth has been building toward this conclusion. It looms over each of these verses. While wisdom indeed excels over folly, no one remembers either the man or his wisdom. It passes as swiftly as the vapor of the wise man's life. Solomon sees here prophetically, too, as well, the failure of his program when it comes to his own sons. No sooner will he reach room temperature than Rehoboam will foolishly take the counsel of the young men over the older, wiser ones, right? You remember this from 1 Kings? Turn over to 1 Kings chapter 12 for just a minute. Once again, as we've pointed out before, one of the reasons this is a conundrum, a puzzle, is because you are expected to have other texts at your elbow. Proverbs, 1 Kings, where we see the effects of wisdom and folly in Solomon's own life. 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 6 to 11. "Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who had stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive, saying, 'How do you advise me to answer this people?' And they said to him, 'If you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever.' But he abandoned the counsel that the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. And he said to them, 'What do you advise that we answer this people who have said to be lighten the yoke that your father put on us?' And the young men who had grown up with him said to him, 'Thus shall you speak to this people who said to you, your father made our yoke heavy, but you lighten it for us. Thus shall you say to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's thighs. And now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. But my father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions.'" Foolish advice, folly. No wonder Koheleth is grieved. Despite his assiduous labor over this work, composed with great skill in order to sharpen and hone his son's skills in ruling this people, the very first decision that son will make is folly, isn't it? Folly. For which all of God's people would suffer for generations hence. The kingdom was divided thereafter, was it not? Tell me now. You tell me, in what sense was Solomon forgotten? in what sense was he forgotten? Did Rehoboam forget the memory of his father? Did he have some deficiency of memory, perhaps an early onset of Alzheimer's, that caused him to obliterate the recollection of his father in the neurons of his brain? He did forget in the biblical sense. He did not forget in the sense of recollection as we consider remembrance, do we? We call this the Zakar motif. Zakar, the Hebrew for remember. There is a remembrance motif all through Scripture. One remembers, as we saw in the reading of the law today, one remembers God's covenant so as to obey. The exhortation all through Deuteronomy, don't forget, remember the Lord your God. One remembers God's covenant so as to obey, keep its ordinances, be faithful to the suzerain who cut that covenant with you. But on his part then, the suzerain, the king, God remembers as well. He remembers so as to bless those who are faithful, but also to curse those who disobey and forget him. Rehoboam did not experience early onset of dementia, but rather the overwhelming consent of depravity. It wasn't dementia, it was depravity, wasn't it? He forgot in precisely the covenant sense that his father feared he would, and in the way which Solomon observed all foolish kings forget. Well, how blessed we are, how fortunate that we're so much wiser. We've made so much progress since then, haven't we? Living in an enlightened age under such wise and enlightened princes. If only. Of course, when considered, we see that our generation is really no different, is it? In fact, our generation seems to be honing the skill of covenant forgetfulness. Do you know the concept of historical blackout? Historical blackout. It is the deliberate strategy of inculcating forgetfulness in a populace by ignoring and/or revising history so as to manipulate it. Harry Elmer Barnes, in his excellent book, Revisionism and the Historical Blackout, that's the title of his book, Revisionism and the Historical Blackout, chronicles this process in our own country when it comes to our economy and the Constitution. Statist progressives who inhabit our institutions of learning and governance have deliberately distorted the small government, free market economy envisioned by our founders and blackened out its memory from generations of public school students. And I think you see many of them on the Occupy Wall Street streets now of our cities. Even the biblical roots of that constitution and economy have been long forgotten and distorted when remembered. Have the names of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, or John Adams been expunged from our collective memories? No. They resonate with us, don't they? But most certainly what they taught, believed, and bequeathed to us in the Constitution and its principles has been forgotten. This is indeed the sense of forgetfulness that the Bible tells us about too. Do you know what the party slogan was in George Orwell's 1984? Do you remember? He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. Pick up Orwell's 1984 and read it again. It's very insightful even for our own day. He who controls the past controls the future because it can be manipulated, shaped, and shaved, right, for people's memories. He who controls the present controls the past. In fact, the sole job of 1984's protagonist, Winston Smith, was to change and alter the record of the past according to the needs of Big Brother and the party in the present. A hero today could be a scoundrel the next. A beloved party member from generations past, fond in the memory of history, could suddenly evaporate from the collective memory, for all intents and purposes never having existed. This is the sense in which Solomon means there is no enduring remembrance. There is no enduring remembrance. Or as Hegel put it, what we learn from history is that man does not learn from history, does he? We forget. To the ephemeral nature of wisdom among princes, Solomon gives his lament and his refrain. He says, I said it in my heart that this is also vapor. You see how that is a better translation, I hope, than vanity or meaninglessness? I said in my heart that this is also vapors. Wisdom, vapors. It disappears and passes with the next generation. It is forgotten by the next generation. Not that wisdom is futile or fruitless or vain, but that it does not last. It does not endure, but comes and goes as quickly as a dust devil at craters of the moon, as fleeting as a lovely rainbow mist floating off of the falls, as ephemeral as the approval numbers for a failed president. Couldn't resist, sorry. But not only does this obtain for government, for princes, for kings, for rulers, but also for each and every human that is in possession of a modicum of wisdom and sense too, doesn't it? That brings us to point 3, verses 16 and 17. Forgotten. The wise king knows some things about his people as well that generations hence will not remember, even though this brings him sorrow. Verses 16 and 17. Note how Koheleth underlines and emphasizes the motif of forgetfulness here, such that even death, the death of men, serves this theme. How the wise dies just like the fool, i.e. in forgetfulness. The emphasis is not upon death qua death, but on its manner. That is, the wise die in the great sea of forgetfulness just as the fool. I remember my mother and my father very vividly and fondly, and such that I try to model their positive traits and eschew their negative traits too. They weren't perfect. I still see their faces. I see their faces. I remember their mannerisms and their habits, the little tics and so forth, and their ways. I can hear their voices echo in my memory. I remember their touch, such that I can still feel the roughness of my father's beard, the softness of my mother's cheek. I remember my parents. I also remember my grandparents, but far less distinctly. My father's father was a simple, hardworking man who loved the Lord. I always remember him as a wise and a good man. His father, my great-grandfather, I never knew him. I never saw him, never even saw a picture of him. I have no knowledge of him except for a few vague references to his early death and his alcoholism, too, and that he emigrated here from Ireland. My great-grandfather was never held up in our family circles as a particularly positive role model. And what are the generations of Basses previous to this? I have no idea. They're all lost to me in the mists of forgetfulness. So there you have it. The sum of their lives and memory and wisdom. You'll never know them. You will never know them. And you could probably care less. That's okay. You have enough to deal with in your own families. All of the bitter experiences, the hard toil, the joyous conquest, the victories, the wisdom gleaned from experience accumulated over some 223 years, that's the sum, as near as I can reckon, of my father, my grandfather, and great-grandfather's lives, 223 years. There it is for you, summarized, concentrated in a few brief memories and bromides of a son of the Bass family. Of my great-grandfather, yea, my great-great-grandfather, the words of Koheleth are true. There's no enduring remembrance. Well, soon even the memory of my wise grandfather and my foolish great-grandfather will fade, won't they? They'll slip into that great sleepy sea of forgetfulness, too. Of course, that will never happen to me. No. I'm taking steps to make sure that never happens to me. I'm going to have a marble statue built and insist that my kids haul it around wherever they go and put it right in the middle of their living rooms. I'll write books. I'll become famous. I'll set Olympic records. I'll compose symphonies that will be played centuries hence. Will I be immortal then? Will I be remembered then? The other day, Dennis Miller interviewed Jim Schwartz, coach of the 5-0 Detroit Lions. So there, you football fans. The Detroit Lions this year so far are 5-0. Well, after the interview, he commented on Schwartz's hard work, his success, his determination. In Miller's eyes, Coach Schwartz was one of those who was on a single-minded quest for that golden ring, that elusive prize, a Super Bowl victory. And why not, Miller quipped, when he does, he'll be immortal. This is the kind of thing I've been recounting for you. This is the worldling's immortality, isn't it? Coach Schwartz will live forever in the memories of who? A few pathetic, diehard football fans like me? Well, for how long? Till I'm gone? They'll just use my Detroit Lions t-shirt as a rag, my kids. Tell me, who won Super Bowl 39, quickly? Super Bowl 18? Super Bowl 23? Who knows? Who remembers? Who cares? On and on we could go. And in the words of that famous philosopher, Coach Mike Ditka, who in a press interview soon after one of his most aggravating losses, when the reporters were asking him all kinds of irritating questions about the performance of his team, he finally threw papers in the air and he said, "Over in China, there's a billion people that don't even know we played today." Great philosopher and coach Mike Ditka. Not many generations hence, not only those billion people in China, but not very many people will even remember that there was a game called football, right? Much less that Jim Schwartz and the Detroit Lions won the Super Bowl in 2012. There is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in days to come, all will have been long forgotten, Solomon says. For Koheleth, as for all men who think past their noses, for Koheleth and us, the gut response is his. So I hated life. This does not denigrate, does not turn him on 180 degrees, the opposite from wisdom in this. This is his gut response. This is his emotional response to the circumstances as they lie on the ground. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. So once more he returns to his world under the sun. Under the sun. Is that starting to get under your skin a little bit as you read through this book? Is that starting to goad you a little bit, provoke you a little bit? I hope so. That is that life that is lived apart from a word from God. That life that is lived where revelation from above is silent. The voice is silent. Made of stone, made of bronze, the skies. Unseen, unrecorded, this voice. This life that is lived as ignorant and forgotten as the memories of Eden. This place, this world, this life that we know is such that it's as if we lived it in a Tupperware piece with the lid on, right? That's the sense of under the sun. We live under the lid, under the sun. Now, I submit to you that all men can relate to this. This is precisely what Koheleth is evoking and hopefully evoking in you. All of us resonate with this, do we not? What can you do? Because you do. You have a voice from above the lid, if you will, from above the sun. You have it in your laps. You have it in your hearts and your minds. You've been reborn, renewed in Christ Jesus. You know. Your eyes are open. Your ears are unstopped. What can you do? The solution to this riddle, this puzzle, this conundrum, is to point men to the one who does remember. That should be screaming in your brains by now. There is one who does remember, and whose remembrance spells life for those remembered. Precisely because he is the author of life. As we read from Malachi chapter 3, so succinct, so beautiful. Those who feared the Lord spoke with one another, the Lord paid attention and heard them, and a book of remembrance was written before him of those who feared the Lord and esteemed his name. To this you must call those despairing, those grieved by life, those who hate life, because they too see life under the sun as but a vapor. To them you must declare that there will be a day above the sun, there is a day above the sun coming, when books of remembrance are opened. Remember, as we see, we know, don't we? Because we go to the end of the book, we see, aha, there will be books of remembrance that are opened. And God will remember the wicked to curse eternally, but he will also remember the righteous to bless eternally with life with him in the New Jerusalem. May you continue, dear brother and sister, may you continue to remember his covenant. Call others to that remembrance as well. And be found in that day above the sun, remembered. Remembered so as to live by your Creator and Redeemer.